Well, good evening. Hope your week's going well, and certainly the fact that we can be together tonight makes it that much better. So we welcome everyone. We return to our study of Ecclesiastes, and tonight we're going to dive into chapter 3. Frank, would you start our class with a prayer, please?
Our Father in heaven, we're thankful that we're able to come together at this time to study your word. We pray that our minds will be open and receptive to what you would have us to learn. Help us to pray for those that are sick and aren't able to be with us. Ask you to be with our brother who teaches the class, Brother Phil. Pray that you would bless him and give him a ready recall of the things that he wants us to know about this subject of Ecclesiastes. Watch over us through the night. In Christ's name we pray.
Amen. Amen. So the scriptures contain the truth of God. No big revelation there. Sorry, no pun intended. But when it comes to this truth in the scriptures, the book of Ecclesiastes, we see that this truth, a lot of it, is not just found in this book. Matter of fact, it's all around us. And to illustrate that, we have been citing some artistic expressions, some poetic expressions, a lot of it even in pop music. And whether it be lowbrow or highbrow, in the world around us, it is constantly expressed. So we've had a good share of lowbrow poetic expressions, and I'm sure the Rolling Stones would love to be considered lowbrow. I'm sure that's exactly how they would be considered. But I want to read you an excerpt from a poem called Dover Beach by Matthew Arnold. You may have heard of this. You may have heard of him. He's considered one of the greatest poets of the Victorian age in Britain, at least the top five and so forth. And what's interesting about Matthew Arnold is that he had sort of a normal life. He was not like a tortured soul. Matter of fact, everything you read about Arnold biographically basically says his biggest problem was boredom, because he was a school inspector. He went around England inspecting schools. It was sort of a drudgery kind of job. But he got to know a lot of people, and he saw English life, and he put it to verse. And he really had a normal life. He had a good marriage. He had a daughter that he loved and so forth. Dover Beach, some think that he was inspired to write this on his honeymoon. Now, I'm sure if I'd have written something like this on my honeymoon, I'd have been in trouble, because it's got a dark side. Okay, but he was at Dover Beach, which looks out over the English Channel across from Calais, France. And the surf is beating the shores on the cliffs there and things like that. And he has a lot in this poem about nature, but he's not just writing about nature, he's writing about life. So see if this doesn't ring a bell in a lot of what we've been studying from Ecclesiastes. I'm just going to read some excerpts. Dover Beach by Matthew Arnold. This is the second stanza. Listen, you hear the grating roar of pebbles which the waves draw back and fling at their return up the high strand, begin and cease, and then again begin with tremulous cadence, slow, and bring the eternal note of sadness in. Sophocles long ago heard it on the Aegean, and it brought into his mind the turbid ebb and flow of human misery. We find also in the sound thought, hearing it by this distant northern sea. Last stanza. And this is where they think he's speaking to his new wife. Ah, let us be true to one another. For the world, which seems to lie before us, like a land of dreams, so various, so beautiful, so new, hath really neither joy, nor love, nor light, nor certitude, nor peace, nor help for pain. And we are here, as on a darkling plain, swept with confused alarms of struggle and flight, where ignorant armies clash by night. So, some of what we see in Ecclesiastes is reflected in what Arnold wrote, but In chapter 3, we'll see even more. It's easy as you read the book of Ecclesiastes to want to jump in and say, but, wise preacher. And that's a natural kind of response if you're very familiar with other parts of the Bible. But you've got to let him make his conclusions. Because what he's concluding is truth that all humans know. Whether it's Rolling Stones or Matthew Arnold. So what is the truth that all these voices just ring around us? What's the truth that they are proclaiming that we've seen so far in Ecclesiastes? Life is futile.
Seems meaningless.
It's vain. What about that reference to the waves back and forth, sir? Ebb and flow, right?
Repetitive.
Just that cycle, that repetitive cycle. Same old, okay? As Kansas said, same old song. Okay, just over and over and over. So this is where this book is a continual, it's a continual feast for the Christian. Because I think it confirms the choice we've made. You read this book and you're like, I'm glad I made the choice I made to follow Christ, to believe. And this is a great meeting point. And we can say more about this later, but I think it's good to keep dropping this along the way. And that is, when you have conversations with people about eternity and about God and their soul and life, and especially if they're unfamiliar with the Bible, they're unfamiliar with the faith, this is a good place to take them so you can stand on this common ground and say, don't you see this in life? And so what is this saying? Don't you think that maybe the rest of this collection of writings would have something beneficial since you see that this rings so true? And so there we go. We're at a somewhat of a transition now coming into chapter 3. You could call it a dividing point. I like to call it a soft transition. It's like a soft fade. What we've got in the first two chapters is the proclamation that all is vain. You know, I set out to try to figure out the work of man under the sun, and the conclusion over and over in chapters 1 and 2 is that all is vanity. All is a striving after wind. It's just meaningless. Starting in chapter 3, to the end of the book, he takes a little bit different tact. He's going to continue to search and reason and draw the conclusion that life is vain. It's going to pop up again. And he's going to keep asking questions, and he's going to keep probing and searching for meaning in life and so forth. However, he is going to consistently drop insights and advice. He's already starting to do that at the end of chapter 2. So what's at the end of chapter 2, in a way it doesn't make sense. At the end of chapter 2, what was his advice? All is vain, but regarding your work and your life, what?
Enjoy
it anyway. It's like, okay, you just told me that everything's in vain. Enjoy it? Well, I think this chapter helps us even more to understand why this should be the case. So, let's jump into this. Chapter 3, 1 through 8. Zachary, can you read those verses for us, please? Chapter 3, 1 through 8.
For everything there is a season, and a time for every matter under heaven. A time to be born, and a time to die. A time to plant, and a time to pluck up what is planted. A time to kill, and a time to heal. A time to break down, and a time to build up. A time to weep, and a time to laugh. A time to mourn, and a time to dance. A time to cast away stones, and a time to gather stones together. A time to embrace, and a time to refrain from embracing. A time to seek, and a time to lose. A time to keep, and a time to cast away. A time to care, and a time to suffer. A time to keep silence, and a time to speak. A time to love, and a time to hate. A time for war, and a time for peace.
All right, thank you. Last pop music reference. Anybody?
The birds.
Right. But before the birds, they didn't write that song. Pete Seeger wrote it. And he was a folk singer in the same era and actually sort of had a mild folk hit in 1959 with this. And some believe that this is the only pop song that is almost exclusively biblical verse. Seeger added just a few things to it. Okay, turn, turn, turn. Okay, and for that he made a lot of money, by the way, just putting that to this right here, turn, turn, turn. Okay, there's one other line he wrote at the end, I think. But it was the Byrds, who were like a folk rock group, that really made it a huge hit. I mean, it still is played a lot. I mean, even young people know this tune, Turn, Turn, Turn. Well, this describes the ebb and flow of life. The New International says in verse 1, there's an appointed time for everything. And that's what's happening here. And this does remind us of Arnold's description of the waves flinging the rocks back and forth and so forth. So what this is telling us regarding a time to plant and a time to reap and a time to seek and a time to lose and so forth is that life is not all one thing. It's not the same thing all the time. And life is not a constant thing. And we're victims to this ebb and flow. There's a time for this and a time for that. We don't control those times. Time to be born and a time to die, that's probably the extreme. But others too. Time to break down and time to build up. Well, when do you build up? Well, maybe when something breaks down, okay? When do you break it down? Well, when you need to move it out of the way or something like that. And so circumstances create this ebb and flow. And we're riders on this train. We're victims to it. We may be the captain of our own ship, but we're not the captain of the seas. And the seas greatly affect the ship. Earl knows that. He was in the Navy. Now, he was on an aircraft carrier. But even an aircraft carrier, they get tossed around like they were like a toy boat, right? When the seas are rough enough. You ever been on rough seas? I can't remember.
Fairly rough. We never had it really, really bad.
Yeah, no, I kept that stuff out of the way. So, but it's amazing, even that big thing, the sea just puts it where it wants to and the swells and things like that. So, and of course, what's the question of the book? When you read this, a time to weep and a time to laugh and a time to keep and a time to cast away, we're back to this question, what's the profit? So in chapters 1 and 2, especially chapter 2, the question was, my toil. What's the point of my toil? What's the point of my profit? I work and I work and I plan and I invest and I develop my skills and I build this up, but what's the point of it all? Well, that's a good question for this. So here is life happening around us and we're having to respond to it, and what's the point of it all? Well, look at the next section. Vince, will you read verse 9? To 11. 9, 10, 11.
What profit is there to the worker from that which he toils? I have seen the task which God has given the sons of men with which to occupy themselves. He has made everything appropriate in its time. He has also set eternity in their heart. Yet, so that man will not find out the work which God has done from the beginning even to the end.
Now, this section really builds on itself. You know, we understand the chapter and verse divisions are, you know, placed there many centuries later. But chapter 3 really is a fairly cohesive unit. And I want you, and I think part of understanding this section is watching how it builds on itself. This is said and this is said, and he's pivoting off his earlier points. So the stake in the ground that he's driven is life has an ebb and flow to it. And this ebb and flow is beyond our control. Okay? So, he comes to verse 11, and again, he's asking these same questions. Verse 9, what gain has the worker from his toil? Verse 10, I've seen the business that God has given to the children of man to be busy with. So, human beings are on this planet. Why? What's the point of it all? Kind of thing. And in verse 11, what does he say at the beginning of the verse? About God and time.
He's made everything appropriate in his time with the New American Standards.
So earlier he's saying there's a time to plant, time to pluck up, time to break down, to build up, time to weep, time to laugh. And then he says, God has made everything, English Standard says, beautiful in its time. New American says what again? Appropriate?
Appropriate.
In its time, yes. He has made everything appropriate in its time. Oh, this ebb and flow, you mean there's someone who's controlling it? New Century Version says, and it's not a literal translation, but it's a nice translation just to refer to as a you know, secondary reference. New Century says in verse 11, he does everything just right and on time. Does God do everything just right? Yeah. What about his timing? It's perfect. And isn't that part of our problem as a human? Is that is where we rub up and we have the friction with God? What is God doing? Why is he doing this? Why is he not doing this? Why is he doing this now? Why isn't he doing this now? And it's that timing of God. It's his God's action and his timing. Sometimes the problem's with the action. Sometimes it's with his timing. But this is telling us that God is perfect in what he does and when he does it. So this is, you know, there's a lot of visuals of chaos in this book. But this is telling us, this is getting down to another level, that time is not marching madly with no direction. God has a design and he has a purpose. And he has a design and a purpose for all events and all seasons, all times. In other words, God's orchestrating it. So this is one of those moments where he's describing this chaotic, vain life around us where this beam of light just enters in. And this great truth that the ebb and flow of life is actually orchestrated by God. Okay? God's hand is in all of it. And the rest of verse 11, and we've already talked about verse 11 because I proposed at the first class that it's really the theme in a way of the book. It's just one of the most pivotal statements in the book. In verse 11, God controls time perfectly. And what does he put in man?
Eternity.
Eternity is what almost every translation says. Which means, again, it's a time reference. Man is trying to figure out God's timing. He's trying to figure out the ebb and flow and where it's going. He's trying to look at the big picture. And eternity means, yes, post this life, endless existence. But eternity also reflects an ability that God has, and he masters eternity. He completely understands eternity. Humans, it's like, have you ever been looking for something in the dark? You know it's there, you just can't put your hand on it. So humans understand that there is more to life than this life. There is more to time than this time. And man's groping for it. Isn't that what Paul tells the Athenians? You're groping for God? Yes, Rebecca.
I can't remember who told me, but they said that this verse probably meant this verse is basically saying that man has been seeking immortality since the beginning. Like, we had the tree of life at the beginning, and that's kind of what we're seeking.
Yeah.
And that's, he said eternity in our hearts is that we want to be immortal. We want to live forever, but the only way we can do that is through him.
And there's the trick. We want to be eternal like God, but the way we've tried to go about it has been the wrong way. But actually God, when the Bible is fleshed out and concludes, the Bible is saying, I'm going to offer you eternity as a human. But this is the way. That's why Jesus said he was the way.
I think our spirits know that Eden exists, and everything we do is an effort to get back there.
Yeah. Things, I mean, we'll see this in this chapter. Things aren't right. They ought to be. Where does that come from? There's a young man I know that he's a Christian, and he studied, became a doctor, and now he's practicing medicine. Very intelligent young man, and I was with him in a local church even while he was in med school, and he and I taught a class on evolution together, and I approached it from one angle. I don't have the scientific background, but he did. And one of his main arguments, I thought it was so interesting, he's the only person I've really heard say this, you know, he's got some technical arguments, but he said, all these things that humans sit around and wonder about, like eternity and the meaning of life, it serves no evolutionary benefit. If evolution is true, that serves no benefit to sit and ponder that. It's a waste of time. Why are humans always doing that? And it just is exactly the point we're talking about right there.
When you're talking about songs and things, there's a movie and a song, I believe, called Fame. And the line of that is, Fame, I want to live forever.
Okay.
So there's an understanding that something, even though we're dead, that something's going to continue on, or we want something to continue on.
Good line for chapter 2. All that he built up, and then at the end, he wants to leave this posterity, to his posterity, this greatness that he's created, but yet a fool may take it, okay? So even fame is not the way to live forever, but there's that longing. That's a good quote for chapter 2. It really is. So humans want to know where these seasons are headed, the purpose of these seasons, this ebb and flow to time. But in verse 11, verse 11 is just chock full of stuff. Verse 11 speaks of man's limit. What is it?
He can't know all of God's work.
He can't. He can't understand those seasons and that ebb and flow and the purpose behind it. Yeah.
You said the example of growth and something in the dark. Our lives were in the dark, or time is dark. It is dark, and our lives are a flash of light. Everything's there. Everything's moving, but we can't see it all. It goes too fast. Our life is a splash of light in time. Yeah. Everything that God's done is there, but we're not around long enough.
Mm. Yeah.
What people want to gain, it's not just a splash of light, it's just by everything I believe in that way.
Yeah.
That's not where God's got a plan.
Which is a reflection of man's mortality. His mortality so limits him, he can't see it. Yeah, he can't. And I've got this illustration for later on. Let's go ahead and give it now. It's like this. Let's say you have a huge painting, like something like Les does, okay? It's like a big, it's just a mural on a wall. It's giant. And it's like, you know, 12 feet high and 20 feet long. And you come up and you put your nose right up to it and you look, what do you see? You just see a very small part of it. And if you've never seen this painting before and you look at it, you're clueless. You got to back up and see the whole thing. That's what's happening to us. We're just seeing this little speck right here in front of us that we call life, even if we live a long time, compared to what God sees and comprehends. And remember the airport illustration, I think the first class, that a modern busy airport like, you know, Atlanta's airport can just look chaotic. But we know that there is a control tower, but humans aren't in the control tower. Now, jumping ahead of ourselves, as believers, we know there is a control tower. But if you're not a believer, you're trying to figure out, is there a control tower? And who's running it? Yeah, Jeff.
Philip, I'm reminded of Job chapter 38 and on, and how he questions him and explains his majesty and his wisdom, the things that we don't know.
Right. It's interesting how that Job, his search was sort of the meaning and purpose of his life. What had happened to him. The writer of Ecclesiastes is doing that about his own life. Chapter 2 is very autobiographical. But he's looking at the big scope. You know, man under the sun in general. But Job and the wise preacher are both asking the same questions and getting the same non-answer. Yeah.
when I think about the first part of verse 11, he has made everything appropriate in its time. I think the most perfect example of that is the timing of Jesus coming to this earth. And everything that had gone on from Adam and Eve's fall up to that point was in preparation for that. And like you say, you're like this in a moment of time, you can't see it, but you know, and now we have the benefit of the revelation to see that picture. But since Christ, until the, whatever the end of time may be, there are things going on that we can't understand.
Is there a better example of the control of God than that? The plan of redemption. His control of things, his seeing the long term, everything happening just right. You know, and that's why this narrative is here. And the prophets linking it all together and so forth. And there's just this immense benefit to like, oh, God's in control. His timing is perfect.
Well, it makes me think of the references Paul makes to the gospel of being a mystery. It was a mystery until it was revealed through the Holy Spirit.
Yeah.
And now it's not a mystery to us anymore. We have that. We've been given that revelation.
That dovetails really nicely into this. Really does. Okay. So, you know, up to this point in this chapter, 3 verse 10, the question is, why do things happen when they do? Only God knows. And, you know, and I obviously, big time believer in the providence of God. And I think I can look back in some times in my life and maybe explain it a little bit, but I'm very leery of going too far out on that limb. Oh, this is what God meant. You know, when some big event happens, like 9/11 happened, you know, all these religious teachers start popping off. This is why this is happening, you know. We don't know why that happened.
There's a fine line between providence and presumption.
Yeah. Providence is God's side, presumption's our side. There's a big old wall between. Yeah. So, and this goes to Earl's point about the plan to bring the Christ. The rest of the Bible makes this convincing case for believing that God is orchestrating everything and that he's in control and he's worthy of that trust. Because all that he's doing is for our salvation. But we cannot be in on what's going on. We're not in on that. And what are we to do? Well, it's sort of like driving a car. I mean, you can control the car, but you don't control what's up ahead of you in the road. You can't control the road conditions. Trees fall in the road. Rain falls down. Somebody pulls in front of you, all you can do is react and steer the car.
Deer run out in front of you.
There was deer run out in front of a lane and buzz the car up. And you can't. You can only respond to it and do the best you can to steer. And it's almost in a way that this verses, chapter 3, verses 1 through 11, is setting us up even in a way for the rest of the book. Because this is when he starts pouring on the observations and the advice. So, what else can we do? Okay. And hear me just say this. I put trust him in parentheses. The writer here doesn't say to trust God. It's implied. You're trying to figure out the meaning of the events of life. You can't. Only God's in control. Which means you just need to trust God. And we got to that point, but I think it's implied, yes.
So how do you respond to people who say to you, or I guess in my case, I didn't die with the deer strike. Some people do.
Right.
You know, and so someone might say to me, well, it wasn't your time. You know, people say that quite a bit.
Yeah.
So there is an appointed time for everything under the sun, but yet... Am I getting that idea from this, or?
Yeah, let me just make it. Maybe. I mean, I can see that. Yeah. And then this really messes it up. And that's Ecclesiastes 9:11 that says, but time and chance happen to them all. Okay. I mean,
people are pretty adamant about that time.
I mean, it just—I just heard of a week ago, Friday night, of a terrible accident that resulted in a young Christian girl in her 20s dying because a drunk driver ran a stop sign and killed her and almost killed her brother. And she'd been 2 minutes, 10 seconds ahead or behind. Teenage drunk driver ran a stop sign. I don't know.
That's where you need to trust in God no matter what.
It's this right here. And, you know, and we're not told that we have to like the seasons or the particular ebb and flow. That we're like, well, you know, like the idea when something tragic happens, and there have been some schools of thought of religious people, and they're dead wrong on this, that is, oh yeah, your child died, you know, in infancy. You just need to smile and trust God. No. It hurts? Cry. You got bitterness of soul? Fill it. Pour it out. Did we not learn that in the Psalms? Yeah.
That fact, this idea of trusting, you know, we have the benefit of revealed revelation. When each one of us is on death's door, we haven't been through that door yet. We're all going to be there someday. We're going to be at death's door. And we have the benefit of looking back at all of the revelation of God, and knowing what we know really helps us, I think, in this trusting God. We've never experienced death's door. We're getting ready to go through it. But we can trust God that He's in control and it's going to be okay.
Right.
And what alternative do we have? There's not a good alternative to that.
If you're not a Christian, you may face that with fear.
Right.
Just dread. But we can face it with some confidence and trust in God.
Right. And we're headed there.
Because inevitably, look what happened in our conversation here tonight. We got on to death. Guess where his discussion goes? Daryl, then we'll move on.
I guess it just kind of strikes me that this book doesn't just say, trust God and move on. It digs into the fact that it's hard sometimes to get to that place because we don't like not being in control. We've got to go through a process and get to the point where we say, there's nothing, you know, we've just got to trust God and let that be enough, because it would be, I suppose it would be harder maybe to internalize this if it was just one verse that says, you know, life's hard, you got to trust God and then move on, that's it.
he gives a lot of expression to that angst in this book. I mean, he's going to keep doing it, the first two chapters especially. And that is, this is troubling to our souls. It's okay. We just got to get through it. It's hard. Okay. 12 to 15. Olivia, can you read that, please?
I know that nothing is better for them than to rejoice and to do good in their lives, and also that every man should eat and drink and enjoy the good of all his labor. It is the gift of God. I know that whatever God does, it shall be forever. Nothing can be added to it, and nothing taken away from it. God does it, and men should fear before him. That which is has already been, and what is to be has already been. And God requires an account of what is past.
All right, thank you. So, we long to understand time and events. We can't. Only God masters eternity and the ebb and flow of life. So what can we do? Well, several things. What does he say here in these verses? Again.
Enjoy the things of life that you can.
Enjoy. Yeah. Enjoy the things of life that you can enjoy in that moment, okay? And he also says what in in verse 12. Be joyful in what else? Do good. So in spite of the fact that all of life is vain, there's a good way to go about it and a bad way to go about it. That doesn't change. There's still a standard there. And actually, you're enjoying it as what? In verse 13. Whose idea was for us to enjoy it? It's God's gift. Yeah. And this is when he says more about God. Whatever God does in his timing of things, what does he say in verse 14? Is it up for negotiation? Is it alterable? Is there a plan B? No. Whatever he does, he does it. It sticks. God will do what he does, and none of us can change his doings. It's done. And so the question is, once we understand, and then really this is the implied question. This is the implied question. God's going to do what he does. Are we going to trust his doings? Because that's the fact about it. Okay? And in verse 14, he actually says, God does what he does, and the people what? Fear before him. In other words, you recognize he's the one in control. He's in the control tower. He's orchestrating everything. And this helps us. It's just like that concept of fear that we saw in the Psalms. Fear means, yes, there's a fear to God, but there's giving God his place, his superior rule. And this is one aspect of his superior rule. So, I mean, it's very understandable to ask the question, well, how can a person live this way with all this vanity in life, this case that he's built, and he's built a very, very persuasive case. Okay? Well, verse 14 and 15 is answering that. That faith in God holds the key. His will is going to be done. It is superior. It is perfect. And even though we may not see everything and understand everything and certainly can't control everything, rest assured God does. Okay? And enjoy life. And so there you go. It's not like, college kids in the dorm and the big test is the next morning and nobody has studied. And at 10 o'clock, somebody goes, I got a great idea. I go, what? Pizza! Okay? And they have a pizza party for an hour instead of studying. And so this dreaded thing is coming. And so you just ignore the facts. You know, the house is burning. Let's sit down and I need to, sew this button on the shirt, that kind of, it's like you're just enjoying life in some kind of blind way. No. You're fully aware of the vanity of life, but you understand that God is in control. And in spite of that, you take what you can in life and you enjoy it. Because if you really stand there on the cliffs at Dover, and you're watching the ebb and flow of the surf, and you're thinking about that humans have heard that surf going all the way back to the Greeks, and you realize that it's part of that endless cycle of futility, that's going to rob all the joy of everything. But when you realize, yeah, it's that way, but God's in control of all that. There is how we can relax and enjoy it anyway. So, well, it only makes sense, right? And it only makes sense that if he's writing about the ebb and flow of life and the different events and how man can't understand that, but God is in control, that particular events would come up for him to address. And the first one is in verse 16 and 17. Lori, will you read those verses, please?
Moreover, I saw under the sun that in the place of justice, even there was wickedness, and in the place of righteousness, even there was wickedness. I said in my heart, God will judge the righteous and the wicked, for there is a time for every matter and for every work.
All right. what is injustice? How does injustice strike us? Yeah. Not good. How do we feel about injustice?
It's not fair. It's not right.
That's right. Not fair. We have this innate sense of that's not right.
Anger.
Frustration. There's no sugarcoating this. He says, in the place of justice, there was wickedness. In the place of righteousness, there was wickedness.
Hasn't changed, has it?
Has not changed. Not one bit. No matter what society, what system, it just hasn't changed. Okay? But look what he says in verse 17. Two key terms. Okay? What does he call God? Or what does he say God will do, rather?
Judge.
He's a judge. And then once again, he has a reference to what? As he said all through this chapter. Time. Put those two together.
The time will come for judgment.
Justice will come. There will be a time. Because God works things out appropriately. God is so good with vengeance. It's perfect. And you see that too. That's one of the subplots. Earl's talking about the scheme to send the Christ, but one of the subplots throughout the Bible is how he judges peoples. Egypt, Israel, Assyria, Babylon, Persia, whatever. Jerusalem. May God have mercy on us. We not fall into his hands in that way. And then, of course, the other thing is death. Ray Conies, can you read 18 to 22, please?
I said to myself concerning the sons of men, God has surely tested them in order for them to see that they are but beasts. For the fate of the sons of men and the fate of beasts is the same. As one dies, so does the other. Indeed, they all have the same breath, and there is no advantage for man over beast, for all is vanity. All go to the same place. All came from the dust, and all return to the dust. Who knows that the breath of man ascends upward, and the breath of the beast descends downward to the earth? And I have seen that nothing is better than that man should be happy in his activities, for that is his lot. For who will bring him to see what will occur after him?
All right, thank you. Again, got to remind ourselves, this is the view from life under the sun. And while he's, you know, punctuating here statements about God's the judge and God controls all timing and he's perfect, again, he keeps defaulting back to what do you see when you look at life? And what you see regarding animals and humans, what? They all die. I mean, if you just take physical observation, what happens when an animal dies and a human dies? It's the same. The same physical process. Oxygen is deprived to the systems of the body, bleeding, disease, whatever. And then the body stops functioning, and then the body decays. It's the same thing. We don't have time to look at it. A good footnote, Psalm 49, great psalm. It actually says the same thing as this says, but it says more, okay? And basically what it says is that humans need to realize, in spite of their wealth and their success, they're going to die like an animal, okay? But he says more. But anyway, what's happening here is death is being depicted as the hounds that are chasing after us. Now, there's different kinds of ways you can hunt with a dog. Some dogs tree, some dogs flush like birds, but sometimes dogs drive animals to a certain place where the hunters are. The reality of death is intended to drive us to a question. The question's found right here. What is it? Does a man, does a human really die like the animals? Is there more to it? Does the spirit of man ascend upward? Is there more to man's death than what we see with our eyes, like an animal? And so the hounds of death are intended to drive us toward God, to look to God, okay? And that's the question. And that's why it's like you got Ecclesiastes in this hand and a giant question mark. And you got other parts of the Bible in this hand. It's got the answers. The Gospels, the letters of Paul, the Psalms, other places that give us the complete picture. And that is narrow in focus, narrow in scope. Yes, humans die like animals. But humans are not exactly like animals. And humans have a spirit. And where will that spirit go? So, again, in spite of the fact that death is hounding us, the reality is that death is coming to us just like it does a dog or a rat or whatever. What does he say in verse 22 at the end? Or in verse 22, what does he say? Still do what?
Be happy in your activities.
Enjoy your labor. Even with that coming. How can you do that? If you know that even the timing of death is in God's hands.